Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Imagine, if you can, an outspoken political outsider as presidential candidate. He's thin on policy, big on touting his celebrity, and fiercely confrontational. He draws enormous crowds who roar in approval and promises to steadfastly defend the country and vows to fix the corrupt system that's keeping the common man down. His rivals are stunned. Party leaders don't know what to do. And yes, he has really distinctive hair. We are, of course, talking about Andrew Jackson and the election of 1824. And Brady Carlson, NHPR's weekend host and our residential presidential historian, is here. Perhaps you have seen his book, Dead Presidents, briefly noted by the New Yorker magazine. Well, Brady Carlson, so glad you'll still talk with us.
I'm happy to be here.
We could have been describing Donald Trump, of course. Andrew Jackson, they have a lot in common. He was also a celebrity. How did he make his name?
Well, Andrew Jackson was the hero of the Battle of New Orleans, the big final victory for the Americans in the War of 1812. That happened to come a few weeks after the peace treaty ending the war was signed. But nonetheless, it was a huge shot in the arm morale-wise for the United States at the time, and General Jackson, being at the center of that victory, became a national hero and managed to keep his name in the headlines through some of his other military and then political exploits leading up until the election of 1824.
There is, of course, still Jackson Square in New Orleans. What are some of the other similarities, though? I mean, it's really quite uncanny in some ways.
Well, there's a feeling that here's a figure who, his own personal history aside, is representing common people against the powerful and wealthy elites. I mean, Andrew Jackson owned a very large plantation in Nashville, Tennessee. He had made a lot of money in real estate. He was a sitting U.S. senator at the time. So this idea that he was a political outsider in 1824 was a bit overstated. But nonetheless, that was the idea that he was the one sort of shaking up the system. And there were a lot of people on his side who were not part of the usual genteel politics of the time. This was the first, by the way, election where some states were deciding who would get the electoral votes by a popular vote instead of electing individuals as electors who would then choose a president for the state and for the country.
Uh-huh.
So that opened up a whole new avenue for a candidate like Andrew Jackson that wouldn't have been available before.
So he did, in the parlance of the day, draw a whole new population of voters to the table?
It was a whole new coalition coalescing behind him. And because of his celebrity, and of course because he was a military hero, and going back to the days of George Washington, Americans had looked to military heroes as potential presidents, and those factors started to build a groundswell around his campaign.
Mm-hmm. He also was famously thin-skinned, apparently, and quite a rabble-rouser. He had his own sort of shady, or let's say he carried a lot of baggage with him.
He had a volcanic temper, to put it mildly, and had killed someone at least one time in a duel, had fought quite a few, and had the bullets in his body to tell the tale. And in fact, Jackson's own story in his duel was he had taken a shot that landed nearly next to his heart. That would have felled a much lesser person, but he got back up. And under the rules of dueling, you get the next shot if you take the first shot. So he very calmly composed himself, and the other guy had to stand there and wait, and Jackson shot and killed him.
Mm.
Frightening.
Was he married to a model?
This is more a difference, I suppose, than a similarity. Jackson was married to a woman named Rachel, who he loved very much, and he was considered very gentlemanly toward women, and in fact would get very uncomfortable and angry when people would denigrate or insult women. There was some question about whether Mrs. Jackson's divorce from her previous husband had gone through when the two of them got together. And when Jackson ran for president, the backers of his main opponent, John Quincy Adams, brought that up very often and very loudly. They'd say, well, these two were, what exactly were they doing if they weren't quite married? And Jackson's wife died shortly after the election, and he always maintained that that was because she had seen the accusations which were being made about her character and her virtuousness, and was so shocked as a decent Christian woman would have been at that time, that it killed her. And he said, you know, God forgive my enemies. Lord knows I never will.
Whoa.
Which is pretty scary stuff coming from Andrew Jackson.
Someone, old Hickory, I guess, as they called him. Okay, so they certainly had a lot in common, but especially their success being so confounding to party leaders at the time. So give us a little bit of background on this general election of 1824. Who was Jackson up against?
Well, there were a couple of different candidates. John Quincy Adams was the sitting Secretary of State under the previous president. And the way that it had been working up to that point was that the Secretary of State was next in line. The two previous presidents, James Monroe and James Madison, had both served in that job before moving up to the presidency. And in fact, 4 years earlier in 1820, there had been such a consensus around James Monroe's reelection that there had been no real opposition. He ran almost completely unopposed. And so there was an idea at the time that a group of stakeholders, powerful people in what was the only real party at the time, the Democratic Republican Party, would sort of choose a candidate. So Adams was the next in line by the Secretary of State tradition. There was another guy named William Crawford who was a well-known party insider, and the caucus process of the day said, let's go with Crawford. Well, Jackson said, well, I don't want to just go with the next in line, and I don't want to go with the caucus choice. I'm as popular as either of them, and I think I'd do a great job. I'm going to go in. And then, of course, there was also another powerful player in that election, which was Henry Clay, who was a well-known congressional figure, the great compromiser. He was known as a huge political force of the day. And so you have four legitimate political forces at the time all pulling against each other.
And Henry Clay, didn't he throw his support behind Adams, right? If I'm reading the history right, let's put it that way.
The way that it works is in that election, no one got a majority of the electoral votes. And when that happens under the Constitution, it goes to the House of Representatives, which then chooses the next president. There were four candidates, and only the top three get to be part of that election process in the House. Henry Clay finished fourth, so he was out. But as a very well-known political figure in Congress, he had a lot of sway with who Congress might choose. Depending on who you talk to, Clay went to both Adams and Jackson, the two top vote getters. Jackson finished first, and offered that he would sway the House in that candidate's favor if he were to have some large role, maybe the Secretary of State, in the new administration. According to Jackson and his people, he turned the deal down, but Adams then wound up winning the election in the House, even though he had finished second in the electoral vote, and then named Henry Clay his Secretary of State. So to Jackson, that confirmed this idea that Henry Clay had made a deal, he called it the corrupt bargain, and that swayed the House in Adams' favor, even though he was the second place candidate.
Okay, so Adams became the sixth president of the U.S., Clay became a Secretary of State. This is 1824. Then 1828, lining things up for an even more bitter, ill-tempered presidential campaign. What happened?
Well, originally, as the election was first decided, Jackson and Adams sort of shook hands and said, well, great job, you know, nice and good game, the way that people do at the end of a Little League game or something like that. But after Adams names Henry Clay his Secretary of State, Jackson is convinced something's rotten in Denmark, that the powerful elites, the caucus system, the party bosses had struck a blow not only for Adams but against him. And he said, I am not going to take this sitting down. Almost immediately, he instructs some of his lieutenants to build a new political party, a new political movement, and start running a campaign for that 1828 election. And their strategy was essentially twofold. Show Jackson as the man who stands up for the common people, and show Adams as completely beholden to the party bosses and completely ineffective. And Adams, who was a thoughtful and capable and qualified person, but at the time a very poor politician, who once told Congress, we need to make sure that our decisions are, and I'll just quote, not palsied by the wills of our constituents. So saying, woo, essentially, don't let those idiots in your districts screw up your votes. Think harder than they will. And that did not go over well. It was more fuel for Jackson to say, see, this guy doesn't understand us. He doesn't understand our people. He doesn't understand our movements. And the election in 1828 was very different. It was a Jackson. He took it in a walk.
Thomas Jefferson once said of Andrew Jackson, he is one of the most unfit men I know of for such a place. That august place he was describing, Office of the President. Our residential presidential expert, Brady Carlson, is with me. He's describing the many similarities in temperament and tactics between Andrew Jackson and current Republican frontrunner Donald Trump, especially Jackson's populist appeal in the bitterly contested elections of 1824 and 1828. A lot of people within the party are saying, okay, this Trump thing, you know, completely caught us off guard, but maybe it is time for a shakeup in the Republican Party. Maybe things that just haven't been working. Did they get that shakeup with Andrew Jackson?
They certainly did. The Jackson-led party was a very different kind of party, appealing to that common interest. Jackson's own personal politics became the focus of the party. He was, for example, very heavily in favor of westward expansion at the expense of the Native Americans who lived in those lands, and he removed them very forcibly and very violently. Jackson also, unlike Trump, very much distrusted money and banks. He was a big believer in gold and what they called specie at the time. He did not believe in paper money and worked very hard to limit and then eventually just destroy the National Bank. And then what happened as a result of that was the people who didn't believe in Andrew Jackson wound up forming their own political party. So it was called the Whig Party. Long story short, the idea, it was a throwback to the British
Whigs,
which were founded as a check on the power of the king. So they're making a direct reference and saying, here is a man who has too much personal power in the presidency of the United States. And so they named their party, essentially, the whole point of our party is to oppose Andrew Jackson.
Well, it's so interesting, Brady, because, you know, this is a guy who clearly didn't play by the rules, was not, you know, presidential and genteel in his language or his actions. And a lot of people who are looking at the rise of Donald Trump and trying to figure out how this happened, you know, how did people get so far away from the establishment, are saying, well, he's a byproduct of America's obsession with reality TV and celebrity or you know, even hearkening back to the fascism and the rise of Hitler in early 20th century. But this was long before either of those, the rise of Andrew Jackson. So is there a strain in American politics that's bigger than these contemporary questions?
You know, in a lot of ways, there's nothing new under the sun here. I mean, certainly there are things with Donald Trump that we haven't seen before, or at least certainly haven't seen in a long time. I think what it speaks to really in a lot of ways is that there are from time to time these populist movements that crop up. And it's not something that's to the left or to the right, but you'll see a populist movement that crops up either that feels like the government is getting too strong or certain interests are getting too strong or the political party leaders themselves are getting too strong and not necessarily representing the people who are at the bottom rung of the ladder. Even sort of leading up into the last few years, I mean, we saw both the Occupy movement and the Tea Party movement, not necessarily always organic or always a grassroots movement, but tapping into this feeling among a lot of people who are disaffected, disenchanted, or disappointed with modern politics, saying, well, something's not right here, and all we need is some kind of vehicle by which to represent and express that frustration and that disappointment. And along comes a well-known figure who can say, I'm right there with you. I feel just as frustrated as you do. Let's do something about it together. And here we go.
Well, that is also the kind of sentiment that got Jesse Ventura elected as governor of Minnesota. So what happens after that? You know, this flush of new energy, this anti-establishment. How do politics end up after that?
It's interesting that you mentioned Jesse Ventura, because what we have seen over the last few decades in politics is that you've seen the parties really trying to recruit not necessarily experienced politicians or public servants, but people who are well known, so that voters who don't pay a whole lot of attention to the day-to-day workings of a state house or a city council will have somebody that they can say, oh, I like that person, I'm going to vote for him. So you've seen football players who've run for office. You see pro wrestlers like Jesse Ventura, or movie stars run for office.
Arnold Schwarzenegger
is a great example. And so a lot of times what you see is that kind of figure cropping up, just not usually at this level. And so seeing a well-known figure who most people know not just as a real estate tycoon or a business person, but as a reality TV star, saying, I'm running for president of the United States. That maybe is a new thing. In Jackson's case, I mean, certainly he had a power base in Congress at the time. Mm-hmm. But more importantly, what he was able to argue, and really for the first time in American politics, was the only person who is elected by all of the people and by extension represents all of the people is the president of the United States. The Speaker of the House does not represent the entire country. The leaders of the Senate do not represent the entire country. Only the president does. And through that call to the power of his office and the responsibility of the office as the one true representative of the voice of the people, he's able to say, I have a mandate to push these policies through. And that, I think, is something that maybe was easier to do in 1828 than it might be in 2016 or 2017. But I guess, you know, there have been a lot of predictions made about what's going to come in American politics in the next few months, and so many of them have not panned out. So, you know, it's hard to say what's going to come next.
Okay, no predictions, a lot of scratching of the head. Brady Carlson, thank you very much for joining us.
Sure, thank you.
Brady Carlson, he's NHPR's weekend host and our in-house presidential historian of sort, author of the book Dead Presidents. More on the book at wordofmouthradio.org.